Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome everyone. Thanks for being with us today. Well, over the next hour, I'm going to be joined by three very creative guests. My first guest is novelist Seldon Edwards. His new book is called The Little Book, but I can tell you it's anything but a little book. It's 30 years in the making, and at the age of 67, 68, Seldon finally realized his dream of becoming a published author, and I can tell you he's having an absolute blast right now. Talk about an inspiration. He's a living testament to never, ever giving up on your dream. And we'll share more about his journey during our conversation coming up in just one moment. Later in today's show, I'm joined by two very talented, very different filmmakers. Both filmmakers have strong ties to the Pacific Northwest, and both of their films are premiering up here in October. Beyond Greenaway by Sue Gilbert premieres at the Tacoma Film Festival, and Rebuilding Hope by Jen Marlowe shows in Seattle. That's this coming weekend, but we'll talk more about that too later on. And we'll be joined live in the studio by Sue Gilbert and Jen Marlowe around 12:25 today. First, we're bringing you the conversation with novelist Seldon Edwards. And because of scheduling conflicts, we went ahead and pre-recorded this segment last week, and you're hearing it now for the first time. Seldon Edwards began writing his first novel in 1974 as a graduate student. 30 years later, The Little Book, all 416 pages of it, is on bookshelves across the U.S. and Seldon's on book tour. Seldon Edwards was headmaster at several independent schools across the country. He now lives in one of my very favorite spots in America, Santa Barbara, California. Seldon Edwards, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Vicki.
I'm so pleased to have you here. First of all, your book's being heralded as an important book and a book that many people are enjoying, including critics. But also because it really is a testament to Winston Churchill. Many years ago, gave a commencement speech. I think it was one of the shortest in history, when he stood up in front of all his students, the students, and said, "Never, never, never quit." And so, it took you 30 years to write this book and get it to a place where it was actually published. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I didn't intend it that way. I did the first draft when I, as you said, when I, in 1975, when I was a graduate student, and I sent it out. It was a very light treatment of the plot, actually, and I'm glad it didn't get published. But I sent it out to publishers, and it was summarily rejected, and I got depressed and put it away. And then a few years later, I got it out again and added some more details and sent it out again and sent it out, and it got rejected, and I got depressed and put it away. And this went on for 30 years. I probably did about 6 major revisions over the course of that time. And the only thing I will say is that I finished it every time, and that would be my advice to people. You know, finish it.
Right.
So it was a completed version, and then it just became more and more complex over the years. And as you know, it's got a lot of twists and turns in it. And
oh my goodness! Yes. Yeah.
I just added them. then finally, it got right.
Yeah, and it starts. I mean, it's described in some cases as a time travel book, and in others as a historical reflection, because a lot of the history in there is based on truth. But you've also taken some liberty with that to create your own story.
Yes.
How would you describe it in your own words?
Well, people always ask me how I kept going, and one of the reasons I kept going is I completely fell in love with the time period. Vienna at the turn of the century is just a fascinating period, and there's some, as you probably know, there's some wonderful books about that. And since I had plenty of time on my hands over the years, I read a whole bunch about it, and I think that's the main reason I couldn't put it away, is I became fascinated with that. As you say, it's not really a time travel book, although my main character arrives from the present back at that time, but I didn't describe any kind of a mechanism by which he got there. It just, I wanted it to happen, and it just happened.
Yeah. I actually loved what your cousin wrote or said in an article. And I should say it's not the turn of this century. It was the turn of last century, 1897.
Yes,
Vienna,
1897.
Which, of course, just conjures up all kinds of wonderful romantic notions. But your cousin, who's a painter, Patty Luke Lewis, said that over the years, you know, like many people, they say, well, I'm writing a book. They kind of, you know, she said, you might be forgiven for lightheartedly kind of rolling your eyes when Selden talked about his book. But she was just so thrilled when it got published. She said she kept looking up at your name, and she really sees it more about the evolution of the soul in history. Were you aware of that?
Well, no. You know, Michelangelo said, you know, somebody asked him how he carved the David, and he just said, well, he carved away everything in the stone that wasn't the David. And I think that's probably what I did, is just over time I just kept adding details and finally completed the story that needed to be told.
Right.
Some of it was conscious, but a lot of it was just me keeping going.
Right. So tell us a little bit about Wheeler Burden. He's your main character, your protagonist, quite a fascinating character, and somewhat based on you, right? Or your alter ego?
Yes. In fact, the first drafts early on, it was sort of completely me. But then over time, he evolved. I ran into a fascinating character in the late 70s. Who had dropped out of college. Actually, he had gone to Princeton with me and dropped out of college and became a rock musician. And he had some great stories that he told about himself. He was a baseball pitcher. He quit the team in a rather dramatic way. He is a sort of uncontrolled extrovert. And there were a lot of, so I added a lot of details from him. And then in the mid 80s, the rock musician David Crosby was a parent in my school, and I sort of stole some of his identity, too. So Wheeler Burden, over the years, just had this stuff piled onto him, and it just seemed to be a natural evolution, but I did get a lot of the details from people I had known.
Yeah, people always ask authors, you know, where did your inspiration come from? But, I mean, you talk about this at the back of the book in the author's note, and you really did take a little bit of this and a little bit of that and pull it together to make a great story.
Yes, my daughter is an aspiring screenwriter in Hollywood, and she said to me a couple of months ago, Dad, it's really great that you got to say everything you ever wanted to say in a novel.
I read that your bookshelves grew by 50 books when you wrote this. I'm actually surprised it didn't grow by a great deal more, but I'm guessing that's because you spent a lifetime in education.
Yeah, I was a teacher the whole time and a headmaster, and I just started collecting library. The funny thing is, when people know that you're working on a project, they often find books and use bookstores and things and give them to you. And my family did that for me.
Mm.
But I was fascinated by some of the research. There's some great World War II stuff in my novel, including some Winston Churchill material.
Right.
And I loved researching that.
Right. So how did you go about your research? I mean, did you literally bury yourself in books or...?
Well, it was sort of like a hobby, I guess. I knew the material that I wanted to include, and so I would come to a fascinating book, and I over-researched because I would just get interested in, like the deception that the British did during World War II just became really interesting to me, and I ended up enfolding it into my story, but I read a lot more than I needed just because it's fascinating what they did and what they came up with. So,
So you're about 68-ish now, I understand. How does it feel to be that first-time novelist?
It's absolutely fabulous. I mean, I just had this dream. All my life I wanted to have a book, and I wasn't getting anywhere. I kept trying. Mm. And then all of a sudden I have this happen. It's just a total dream. I get to go into bookstores and see my books piles of my books. I get invited all kinds of places, and it's just absolutely wonderful.
I think that's awesome. You were, when you were teaching, not when you were headmaster, when you were teaching, you were an English teacher. Your wife, as I understand it, also was an English teacher.
Yes, both of us are.
Now, did she ever say to you when you were like hunched over the keyboard or the typewriter, when they were all on vacation, did she ever say, "Now, come on, Selden, give it up. Give it a rest."
Yeah, she did. Well, no, she was very encouraging, but she kept saying, why don't you move on to something else? And she would sort of lay new material in front of me and say, why don't you start writing about this? And I just kept going back to the old one. So she and my children were just absolutely amazed when it happened. Mm. And it was a miracle, I have to say.
But as you say, it's evolved, and so maybe you needed that 30 years to get it to,
oh, yes,
you know,
definitely.
To the place
I'm so glad. I mean, the story that is now in the book is the full story, and I'm just so glad that I waited. I'm a slow mover, I guess, and a late bloomer. And I just needed the time. I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but I needed the time.
Well, I want to talk about how it did happen, because it did happen very quickly when it did happen for you, that I'm talking about getting it published. First of all, we need to recognize the importance of a good editor for all writers. I'm a writer myself. We all depend on good editors.
Yeah.
And you were introduced to Pat Lobruto, I believe, in New York, a freelance editor, who helped you develop some unity in the book. And then that led to what?
Well, that was the key difference that... a friend of mine had told me about this fellow, Pat Lobruto, who's a freelance editor, and I hired him, and he was the first person to read it from cover to cover, and he was fabulous. He and I worked together for quite a while, actually, and he's a very professional editor, and he just really helped me bring out the best in the story. But then the other thing was, he knew people in New York City, so he knew my agent, and he started telling my agent about the book as we were working on it. So my agent wanted to read it. And he's a fascinating guy named Scott Miller, a young man at Trident Media, and he made the difference. He read it, loved it. He gave it to Dutton, the big publishing house, Dutton. They had 4 days, and there were, I think, six people on their executive committee, and they read this 600-page manuscript in 4 days and made an offer.
Yeah, I read that the editor at Dutton was so excited by your book when he finally got it that he got up at 4 a.m. to finish it before he went in to make his pitch.
Yeah, he did. To be at zero for all those years and then have that happen is a miracle. But yeah, I had a wonderful editor. I have a wonderful editor at Dutton named Ben Severe. And I love working with him. We worked for about 6 months on it. Because, as you know, it's a really complicated tale, and it needed to be told just right for the reader to keep up with it. And
well, you've got so many characters in it, too. You've got historical characters such as Mark Twain, who actually, I believe, was in Vienna at that time, according to your notes.
Just by coincidence, he happened to arrive just when Wheeler Burton arrived.
Yeah, Sigmund.
So that was really lucky. And then, of course, Buddy Holly is in it.
Mm-hmm.
Sigmund
Freud.
Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
And the Viennese, some of the famous Viennese, and then, I made up a few characters to fit in, too.
Right. So was this your way of actually kind of meeting those people, them?
Yeah. I think over the years it was just a great fantasy of mine. I wanted to meet Buddy Holly,
Right.
So I wrote him in and had Wheeler meet him. So, yeah, complete fantasy on my part.
Let's talk a little bit about... the writing process for you, because you said you didn't write while you were actually teaching, but it was holidays and weekends, I guess, that you just hunkered down?
Yeah, I had free time, and it was hard at the end of the workday because teaching and headmastering took so much out of me.
Sure.
But and weekends and when I had free time, I'm a pretty, I guess I'm sort of a compulsive writer. I love having time by myself and just getting into the writing. I can have 2 or 3 hours pass without any problem at all and just work and work and work on material. I love that.
Is it an organic kind of approach for you, or are you one of those writers who outlines everything?
I'm very intuitive. It's very spontaneous. I just sit down and start writing, and the stuff sort of comes out. And an awful lot of it just was almost like first draft, It just came... It just poured out of me. The story, amazing. You know, there's that question, are you writing the story or is the story writing you?
Yes, yeah.
And I'm definitely in that latter category, I think.
And does that apply to your characters, your character development? Because you did flesh out some really interesting characters too. I once talked with author Terry Brooks, and he said he would audition the characters in his head in a role play kind of thing. How does that work for you?
Well, I think, in my case, I just started with a character that I knew was in there, and I wasn't sure how the grain was actually working in the woodwork, you know. But I would just put the two characters in the scene together, and they would emerge. The most obvious example of that is when one of my characters, Dilly Burden, Wheeler's father, meets the woman who's going to become Wheeler's mother. They meet in a war-torn London or in England, and they just bond in one day. They form their relationship, and they get this sort of witty dialogue going on between them. Mm. And that just happened. I just sat down, and my fingers started to move, and out it came.
Yeah.
And I already had established Dilly as a character, but Wonderful Flora hadn't really come out yet until I started writing that scene, and by the end of the day I had her.
You talked earlier about discouragement. You talked about, you know, you'd get rejected and depressed. How many times were you rejected? Did you keep track or not?
Oh my goodness. I didn't keep track, but there were a lot of, I think about, I submitted the manuscript probably 6 or 7 times over the 30 years, and each time for maybe picked up 5, 6. The last time I do know, the last time I retired in 2003 and cranked out a draft, and that was rejected 9 times. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a very thick skin, and it really made me feel bad.
I was going to say, that's not too many rejections, really, because I know authors who are very well published now, but literally could plaster their walls with rejections.
Yeah, I know. And I actually was writing some other things, too, that were also being rejected. But,
all right.
I had a select group of depressions.
So, yes, a select group of depressions. So you said you don't have a very thick skin toward rejection. Many people don't. How did you cope with it?
That's the hardest part. That was the hardest part for me, because I would really feel like just giving it all up, not only giving up the project, but giving up writing. And I had to sort of fight my way through that. But I don't know, sometimes I would just wake up in the morning and get back on the horse. But it was that's the hardest part. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the hardest part for any unpublished writer.
Yeah, I think it's true in any creative endeavor, really. Even job hunting, let's face it, if you keep getting rejected, people do get discouraged.
Yes. You have an interview and you think it might have gone all pretty well, and then you get a rejection. It's pretty hard.
Well, you obviously had some burning drive inside you, and thank goodness you did, because it's doing, it's come to fruition and is extraordinary in its own right. What kind of advice do you give to young writers? I saw that you were at the Santa Barbara's Writers Conference as an author, right? As a published author, how did that?
Now I get to. I spent years and years going as a student, and
right.
Now I get to go as a writer, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if people ask me and I say, well, you know, there is a craft to it, and you have to keep working on your craft and get better and better. Read a lot. Find the books that you love. I love Pat Conroy and John Irving, J.D. Salinger, E.L. Doctorow. I love those sort of big writers. And
right.
I learned, you know, I would copy them and try to emulate their style, and I loved scenes that they'd written, so I tried to emulate that. So I worked pretty hard on the craft over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But then that main thing I said is be sure to finish it. There are millions of people in the world who are going to write a novel,
mm-hmm.
and at least if you finish it, you can say you have written a novel, and that's very important.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the famous authors who've inspired you. Who inspires you in your day-to-day life? What inspires you in your day-to-day life?
From writing?
Yeah.
You mean?
Yeah.
I am one who loves to get my nose into a big, long book and just sort of devour it over. I'm a slow reader, so it takes me an embarrassing long time sometimes, but just to get into a book and just totally get immersed in it. Of course, one detail is that I grew up without television on a farm in Northern California, and I used to go to movies, double features, when I was a kid. Mm. And I've seen as many movies as anybody I know, and I totally love them. And as you know, my book is very cinematic, that it has a lot of scenes in it that are just straight out of the movie in my head, and that's always been an inspiration to me.
Right. I want to read a quote. You mentioned that you love Pat Conroy's work, and he actually gave you a review on this book. He said, Selden Edwards' The Little Book is a wonderful novel, and I think it has a chance to become a famous one. I've never read a novel like it. I felt my life was changing forever as I savored its many delights and mysteries. How did that make you feel?
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know Pat Conroy, and I just, out of the blue, had him send a manuscript, and I wrote a fan letter. And one day I got an email from this guy, G. Patrick Conroy, and it said he loved my... He uses very salty language. I won't tell you what he said. He said, I am loving your novel, he said, with a few expletives in there. And he asked for my telephone number because he said he definitely wanted to blurb my book. And he called me a couple of days later, and he read what you just said. He read that to me over the phone. Out of the blue.
You're like, is he talking about me?
Oh my God, I couldn't believe it. And since then, he's become a great friend of mine. I talk to him about every month.
Uh-huh. That's awesome. Well, Selden, it's been a delight talking with you, and I am just so thrilled for your success. I mean, to keep going for 30 years and and evolve to, the state that the book's in now, which is awesome. Very interesting, very intriguing story with lots of twists and turns. And what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, just that thank you very much for this interview. It is just a total dream, and I guess I would just say to everybody, it's not going to happen if you don't keep going, and if you do keep going, I hope it doesn't take everybody 30 years, but if you want an example of why it's worth it, I'm the guy. This has just been an incredible dream for me, and wonderful, and late in my life, it's just been a wonderful treat. So,
yeah, well, we can hear it in your voice, and of course, everybody's going to ask you: is there a sequel in process?
Well, yeah, I am. I'm working on another one, and Dutton has already agreed to publish it. So,
oh, excellent.
It'll be 97 when it's finished.
I don't think so. I think you've gone through your training period.
Thank you.
I do want to let listeners know that you're coming to Queen Anne Books on Wednesday, September 30th. I don't have the time. Do you know what time, Selden?
I don't either. There? I think it's... I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me. I think it's 7 o'clock, but I don't know that.
Okay, well, we'll look it up and put it on the website. But Selden will be at Queen Anne Books Wednesday, September 30th. Selden Edwards, I wish you all the best. And I can tell you're enjoying your book tour, so I won't tell you to enjoy it.
Thank you, Vicki. This has been a real pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. And that was a pre-recorded interview with Selden Edwards. We pre-recorded because of scheduling conflicts, but he will be actually at the Tacoma Library tomorrow at 7 p.m. And he'll also be at Queen Anne Bookstore at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, September 30th. I'm joined now by two very lively filmmakers, two very talented and lively filmmakers, and we'll be back to talk to them in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-7000. 4255-2500, pause.org, or 425-787-2500.
Join us October 12th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair to learn about the movement that's already helped millions of people. Following the gang-related murder of his son, Azeem Kamisa was devastated, but he now carries his inspirational message of forgiveness, peace, and hope into the world. Hailed by dignitaries such as the Dalai Lama, former President Bill Clinton, and Al Gore, Azeem joins Vicki St. Clair for Conversations Live on Monday, October 12th at noon Pacific. Call 800-495-7617 for more information.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
This is Alternative Talk, 1150. Got it? Cool.
I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The waves slipping away.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And as I said before the break, we're joined now by two very lively, two very talented ladies, both filmmakers, both have ties to the Pacific Northwest. My one guest is Sue Gilbert. Her film is called Beyond Greenaway, The Legacy, and Jen Marlowe, who made Rebuilding Hope. I want to welcome both of you to the show today.
Thank you. Thanks. Great to be here.
We have about 30 minutes, so we're going to talk about, with each of you individually about your film, and then we'll have a general conversation. So why don't we start with Sue, and I'm going to introduce you right now, and then we'll introduce Jen properly when we talk about your film. I think it's less confusing that way. Sue Gilbert is a writer, producer, director, and the principal of her own production company, Umbaria, and Sue will correct me if I butchered that pronunciation there. She worked for several years in L.A. on a variety of productions and in the early 80s made her first award-winning documentary called Greenaway. After several years in retirement, she surfaced again to make her new documentary film called Beyond Greenaway, The Legacy, where she explores the legacy of inherited wealth and much, much more. She touches on a myriad of topics, including marriage and divorce, drug therapy, values, belief in God. And while many of us in this economy might think extreme wealth would be the answer to all of life's problems, we may find out that not to be true. In fact, Sue says this. She says, it's easier to come out as a gay person than a wealthy person. So we'll ask her what she means about that in just one moment. So, Sue, your film is called Beyond Greenaway, Wealth and Values Through Three Generations. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Greenaway comes from the name of the island where I grew up in Connecticut, and it's a small private island off the coast. And to me, it symbolizes the isolation that can happen with extreme wealth and the sense of privilege. And so I thought my first film was called Greenaway, and it explored my parents and their lifestyle on the island and very much captured sort of their old Edwardian way of being and covered topics like my mom's LSD therapy and her radical politics. And I actually mean radical conservative politics, she actually wanted to kidnap Nixon to take him out of office because she felt he was much too liberal and he was ruining the country. So anyway, my parents made engaging characters, and I thought that was it for me for a while for filmmaking. And then about a couple of years ago, it occurred to me that there was potential for a sequel, that film, the first one, captured an era and a time back in the early 80s, but actually my parents were more like from the 40s and 50s. And, you know, people were asking me, well, given this upbringing, what are your siblings like? I mean, do you have the same values? Do you treat people kind of the same way? What are you guys like? So I thought, wow, here's a chance to really sort of get into the heart of our family and take it to its broader aspect. And audiences could perhaps relate to how they and their siblings have come out given their backgrounds. Mine just happens to be extreme wealth, but other people have been lost in the desert and displaced and are refugees. And other people, just everybody has their challenges. So in a long way. That's kind of what was the impetus for doing this film.
I also think it's a great love story in many ways. You have five siblings. There's obviously a great deal of love between all of you. And the love story between your parents, who are married for, I don't know quite how long, but a long, long, long time, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So what Greenaway, the first film you made, was an award-winning film. What did you hope to gain by expanding on this, by bringing Beyond Greenaway to the screen?
Well, I thought it would be a great way to take a viewer into a slice of life, really, that they would otherwise not know about. And I think that's one of the great privileges of a documentary filmmaker is you get to go places and penetrate lives and bring them back to the audience so that there can be some richness exchanged and we can all learn and grow by seeing how other people live. So that was really one great reason I wanted to do it. And I think the other reason is just as a filmmaker, I thought that they would be great characters. And I did so much want to say more than just here's a wealthy lifestyle. It was to communicate that the basic thing that holds us together is our love for each other as a family. And it did come from our parents. They were married, I think about 42 years until my mom died. So
yeah, and your parents, I mean, they really came from an era that's gone in many ways. And it's interesting to look back at how they thought and, their views on marriage and politics and religion. We talked a little bit about this before we started the show, about vision. Every filmmaker, author, every creative has a vision in their mind before they start a project. Did this end up being something different than your original vision?
This was much broader and much more layered, this film, than my original vision. I think I saw it as more of a sort of a linear piece. We go into it topic by topic. And what's come out of it is that there are more character threads than I had anticipated. There's actually character arcs where three of us come to feel differently about our upbringing at the end of the film than we did as kids or than we did at the beginning of the film. And so I was quite surprised by that sense of redemption. And then one of my brothers pulled a complete surprise on me by wanting to talk about my mother's escape ring. So that totally took me by surprise. And that also gave the film a little extra spark.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, we were shooting very late that day, and I had to wrap the crew. And my brother kept saying, I have this ring. I want to talk about Mom's ring. And I kept saying, well, yes, of course we can talk about the ring. Let's just get everything else done first. Actually, we don't have time for the ring. And he said, well, don't worry, I'll just have it in my pocket. So he pulls out the ring at some part of the interview, and he starts to talk about how my mother felt that when this country goes into socialism and communism, she's going to have to find some way to take wealth with her. And so if she puts all of her big jewels in this gloppy ring, her persecutors will never think it's a real ring.
And it was hideous, wasn't it?
It was just horrible. It was horrible.
Worth millions, but hideous.
It is hideous, hideous, hideous. So he brings out this ring, and his girlfriend is sitting next to him. And we've already discussed marriage, and we've already past the point where he's basically said, well, you know, I think marriage is good, but, you know, it's kind of an ideal and good luck to those who try it. And in that shot, her face in the background just fell. So we've already covered marriage and we're on to other things. Suddenly out comes this escape ring and he starts heaving and turning into, you know, getting all red-faced. And pretty soon he starts asking her, will you be my bride? Totally took all of us by surprise. I think the cinematographer, Gabriel Miller, hung in there beautifully and widened the shot appropriately. I was kind of teary. I know the sound lady was kind of teary. It was very moving because he actually probably hadn't proposed to anyone. I know he hadn't proposed to anyone in probably 50 years, 40 years. So it was a turning point for him.
So I see your film more than did tell this the story of your family. Well, I found it absolutely fascinating, and there's a ton we could talk about, but I want to bring Jen Marlowe in now, who's sitting patiently waiting, and have her tell us about her film. And let me just introduce her properly. Jen is a human rights activist. She's a filmmaker, writer, and the founder of Donkey Saddle Projects. She has nearly a decade decade of experience in peace building and conflict resolution in some of the worst war-torn locations on earth, including Bosnia, Herzegovina, Palestine, Israel, Afghanistan, and the list goes on. And she's been a featured speaker at many schools and universities, including Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Brown, and again, the list goes on. Jen traveled to northern Darfur in East and eastern Chad as part of a three-person team to make the documentary film, The Darfur Diaries. And she also authored the accompanying book on that. For her new film, she traveled once again to Sudan, this time with three lost boys who were returning home to look for surviving family members and with the hope of making a difference. Jen's new documentary film is called Rebuilding Hope. Welcome, Jen.
Great to be here.
And tell us a little bit about your film. And we have two very different filmmakers here, two very different stories. I do see a commonality, and if we get time, we'll talk about that later. But tell us about your film.
Well, like you said in the wonderful introduction, Rebuilding Hope is following three young men who are from South Sudan, and they had fled the civil war in the late 80s when they were tiny kids, and they had grown up most of their lives in refugee camps, first in Ethiopia, then in Kenya, and they had come to the United States in 2001 as part of a resettlement program, and that's when this whole group of young men was given the nicknames the Lost Boys of Sudan. And three of them in 2007 were planning their first trip back home to Sudan, the first time going back home since they had fled 20 years before as tiny kids. And I went with them to document their journey. And in many ways, the journey had three different elements of discovery. And one was the personal discovery. What happened to their families? Were their parents alive? What happened to their villages? And then there was the element of political discovery, that South Sudan had signed a peace agreement in 2005 with the northern government. But was the peace holding? Was South Sudan on the road towards peace and stability, or was it in a slow slide back towards civil war? And then the third question that they were trying to answer was, how could they now contribute something to the communities that they had left at home? One of the young men was studying to be, had just graduated with a degree in education as a teacher. Another one of the young men was studying to be a nurse. They wanted to use the skills that they had gained to really bring some direct benefit back to their communities.
Yeah, and what three amazing men. How did you come across them in the first place?
It actually grew out of my first film, Darfur Diaries, and there was a journalist I had met. His name's David Morse. He had already met the young men and was planning on accompanying them on their trip back to write about the trip. And he and the young men had been talking about how important it would be to document it with film, especially because they knew that they wanted to. You know, one of the young men knew he wanted to build a school. The other young man knew he wanted to help with healthcare, and they recognized the importance of documenting it to get support for their projects. So then, when this journalist David and I met for coffee, and he knew of my previous work on Darfur, he essentially asked me, would I want to come with them and make a film? And I had already been trying to find a way to get to South Sudan, because through my work on Darfur, I very much understood how inextricably linked the two regions of the country really are.
Now, did you choose Sudan for what reason? Because there are many places in the world that have incredible suffering. What was it that drove you there in the first place?
Initially, it was in 2004, and that was when the crisis in Darfur was really newly erupting. And at that time, the media was not covering. This was before George Clooney had gone to Darfur, before Angelina Jolie had told us we should care about it.
Right.
And
right.
At the time, I was still living and working in Jerusalem, doing conflict resolution work with Israeli and Palestinian youth. And a former colleague of mine, Adam Shapiro, was already making plans to go to Darfur because he wanted to make sure that this crisis was being covered. The mainstream media was not doing the job, so he felt it was incumbent upon him and his other colleague, Aisha Bain. They were going together. And as Adam was telling me about what was happening in Darfur, and I was horrified. I was horrified both by what was happening and by the fact that I hadn't known about it until that conversation. So I ended up jumping on board the team, and the three of us went in fall of 2004. And then, of course, once you go to a place, for me at least, I don't believe in hit and run activism. My engagement always tends to just further and deepen, and so then that led me to South Sudan.
Yeah, you're very invisible on your film. Obviously, with Sue's film, she's visible in that because it's part of her family's story.
Sure.
You chose not to be in the film. I did think I see one shot of you in there. But you're not at all visible in there. Why did you actually told it through the eyes of the boys?
Well, that's how I approach all my work, whether it's filmmaking or writing. I view myself as an activist primarily, and I view the camera or my laptop computer as tools. And in many ways, I look at my camera as a platform for people to speak for themselves in their own world, in their own words. I think so often, if these areas of the world and if these stories are covered at all, which is far too infrequently, it's through the perspective of the Westerner. It's through the perspective of the American rather mm-hmm. than people speaking for themselves, by themselves, on behalf of themselves. So that's a very important aspect of all the work that I do.
Yeah, and especially once celebrity gets involved, they tend to take all of the attention. But seeing this story through the eyes of those three boys, I actually understood what's happening in Sudan really for the first time, I think.
Oh, I'm glad
I think
to
you
hear
did
that.
A good job of explaining that, because the war's been going on for many, many, many years. And you didn't hit us over the head with history, but I really, for the first time, understood what's happening there. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jen Marlowe and Sue Gilbert. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Real people, real life, real radio. Really. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. I have two Northwest filmmakers with me today. And I have to tell you, our listeners, that I thoroughly enjoyed both of these films. You know that regular listeners know that I watch a lot of documentary films. But I really, really, truly enjoyed both of these, both very different films. Jen Marlowe is the filmmaker of Rebuilding Hope, and Sue Gilbert is the filmmaker of Beyond Greenaway, The Legacy. And let's just ask both of you, especially there were scenes in both films that I found very moving and emotional, and probably more so in Rebuilding Hope because it dealt with little kids who, you know, have no say in where they're born and how they're raised and all that kind of stuff. But as filmmakers, how do you not, let me ask you first, Jen, how do you not get so emotionally involved that you become blind to telling a good, true story?
Well, I think you should become emotionally involved. I always am emotionally involved in the stories that I'm telling, and I try not to let my emotions interfere with my ability to tell the story. But I definitely do not subscribe to the notion of the journalistic concept of having to be unbiased or having to be quote unquote objective. I don't think anyone ever truly is. I think we all have our own perspectives, and if we own them and we allow ourselves to become truly engaged, it should only enhance our ability to tell the stories.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Sue? Because you're talking about something very personal. You're talking about your family. And were there any surprises there for you? Did you find yourself getting very emotional at times?
Actually, I didn't. I pre-interviewed them. And so they kind of knew what to expect. And therefore, they were comfortable with me in the questions. But I think, and I agree, I totally agree with Jen. I think emotion is important. I think it's a sublayer to everything. And I think it's what we resonate to. Whatever's happening intellectually on screen, there's got to be an emotional level or we're going to be bored stiff. And as filmmakers, there's got to be a passion about what we're doing. But where it hangs me up is mostly, really, in this case anyway, in the editing room when it comes to decide, well, should we take this shot and this scene or this shot and this scene? And they may have very different contents. Because it was my family and because I am very attached to them, you know, I really had to rely on my editors to for their clear vision. So that was much harder. And in terms of other surprises, besides the engagement ring, there really weren't any. I think I was surprised and honored that they were so open with me, mm-hmm. my family, and so willing to get into places that may have been a little tough for them. I'm thinking of my brother Lee talking about his childhood. He had a very painful time growing up. And I was so honored that you can see it in his face, and he was right out there. So, and the other part of me is that I want to take care of him as the interviewer, as a person. And that can interfere at times with just letting him go through his process.
Right,
and
right.
Letting him show us his emotion. So I had to really train myself to step back.
It was so interesting to see how all six siblings had very different perspectives on certain things. They all agreed your parents loved one another. Your eldest brother says they went, had knocked down, drag out fights. Your youngest brother said, oh, they never fought at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You say you heard them bickering and that you thought, why bother getting married?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always really interesting to see different people's perspectives. One of the moments that was moving in your film, Jen, in Rebuilding Hope, the story of the three lost boys in Sudan, was... I'm going to read the soundbite here. There were two women talking, and they said, we don't want to bear any more children because our kids don't survive. And the other one said, we'd rather die alone childless than bury our children. We think there's peace over there, but peace hasn't brought everything that they need to still live a good, sustainable life, right?
Yes, absolutely right. And I think that's one of the global issues that the film tries to touch on is this idea, the connection between peace and development, and the idea that peace is more than just a cessation of violence. And the same woman who's made that statement says at a different point of the film, when we're asking, has this peace agreement helped? Is life better now that there's peace? And she said, well, we're no longer being shot. We're no longer running into the bush. But aside from that, nothing else in our lives have changed. We still don't have any resources. We don't have any access to basic health care, to education. And that's one of the things what I'm really trying to underscore with this film is how connected this idea of a sustainable peace is to there being concrete benefits on the ground, development, health care, education.
Mm. Now, there were as many as 27,000 young men and women who were displaced or orphaned during the Second Sudanese Civil War. 4,000 of those were brought to America, and that's what we know as the Lost Boys. What do they think of that Lost Boys tag?
The young men, you know, I've actually found that I have a harder time with it than the young men that I know. We had long conversations with them about what terminology to use to describe them in the film. And I was actually, in my mind, I wanted to go with something other than Lost Boys because they're not boys right now. They're men. They're young men. Yeah. And at least the three young men that are in the film are anything but lost. They are so focused and so driven, and they know what they want to achieve and how they're planning to get there. I think they themselves embrace the name much more than I did.
Mm. What struck me, and this is true of both films again, is talking about responsibility. Sue, in your film, your brothers, your sisters, you all talk about responsibility. You grew up in this incredible wealth that most people can't even imagine. But you all talk about the responsibility of that wealth. Share a little bit about that with us.
Well, our parents were philanthropists, and they were involved in many, many things, particularly I remember at a local level, the museum and the, you know, all kinds of urban redevelopment. My father was incensed that builders were going to tear down what were acknowledged, what were slums, and then build high rises that these people could never afford to be in again. Therefore, they were really taking their homes away. This wasn't subsidized housing. So I got to watch him in the political arena as a kid. And my brothers have taken it on, and I've taken it on. I think the thing for me with giving this abundance back is just to make sure that it isn't coming from a sense of duty, that I give back where I feel it will do the most good and where I'm, again, emotionally invested in some issues. So, that was a huge part of my inheritance, was the knowledge that that is part of my responsibility.
Mm. And Jen, with the Lost Boys, they all talked about responsibility. The three of them talked about responsibility. And I was struck by their heavy sense of responsibility. You know, here we are. We are no different to any of the other kids who were orphaned during that time. And we got the privilege of going to America, getting an education. We have to pay something back. And one I'm thinking of in particular, I think it was Core. I can't find my notes right now. I've got too many notes. But he said that he'd been sending money back for his brother. His little brother was sold into slavery. Been sending money back for him. Then he had him sent to a cousin where he thought he was being better looked after, but he apparently wasn't being as well looked after as he'd hoped. And he just had this terrible sense that he'd failed his brother. But yet here he is going to school full time, working full time to take care of his brother and try and raise money to take medicine back to Sudan.
Absolutely. I think all three young men, and I think, in fact, many survivors of war and trauma, you know, carry survivor's guilt with them. And these three young men absolutely carry that. And I think you're right. I think Core expresses that the most consistently and the most clearly throughout the film, this tremendous burden, this tremendous sense of responsibility, and this tremendous sense that they need to give something back, that they need to, that hard as their lives have been and as much as they've suffered, they're now in a situation of relative privilege. By U.S. standards, the situation that the young men are living in are not privileged at all, but by the standards of the family that they left behind in Sudan, they are privileged and they feel a tremendous responsibility and a burden.
Yeah, and I was saying to Sue before the show that the commonality, I see several commonalities with responsibility and that. But, you know, in Sue's case, the wealth was monetary, largely monetary. And with these boys, it's education and then what they're doing with that. It's not just getting the education, but they're actually doing something useful with it. Well, I don't want to run out of time before we tell our listeners where they can see both of your films. So, okay, Jen, tell us when and where.
Well, I'm very excited to report that actually the world premiere of Rebuilding Hope is this weekend in Seattle.
And you can hold up your little, we have a camera over there.
So here it is for the camera viewers. And it's going to be Friday at 7 p.m. and Saturday at 2 and 5 p.m. at the Grand Illusion Cinema, which is in the U District. It's at the corner of 50th and University Avenue. And all details are on our website, rebuildinghopesudan.org. So, and the young men from the film will be there, and they'll be with me. We'll be having Q&As after all the screening. So it's really a chance to meet them, and they're inspirational.
Very good. So give those times one more time.
Friday, 7 p.m., Saturday at 2 and 5 p.m. at the Grand Illusion Cinema.
Okay, and the website is rebuildinghopesudan.org. All right, Sue Gilbert, give us your lowdown here.
Well, I'm very pleased to announce that Beyond Greenaway is having its Northwest premiere at the Tacoma Film Festival this coming weekend, and it will be screening at the Tacoma Art Museum at 10:30 in the morning for you early birds. And I will be there and be doing a question and answer afterwards. It will be great fun, so I hope you join us. You can find the directions on TacomaArtMuseum.com. And you can hear more about my film at beyondgreenaway.com. So,
okay, beyondgreenaway.com. And what would you like to leave our listeners with today? What do you want to tell them?
I would just like to leave everyone with the thought that wherever we come from, whatever our backgrounds and whatever our journeys, there's always a way to reach out and incorporate a new perspective. And I just invite you all to think about that.
And I want to congratulate you on making a superb film. Really superb, very interesting. And I hope a lot of people get to see it.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Jen, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, final thought, huh? you know, there's a lot of things that I hope people will take away from seeing the film. But I think if I had to choose one of them, I think it's this idea of responsibility, because I think we're all responsible for the world that we live in small ways and in large ways. And I hope that it will probe and inspire people to really examine where we are in the world and how we can engage more deeply.
And what about if we do want to engage? Not everybody can give money, but they might want to give time or real quick.
Well, you know, I actually have a policy that I don't like to give an ABC or a laundry list of, okay, you know, sort of spoon-fed activism. I think it all starts really with the question of looking at yourself in the world and, you know, not only recognizing, I think, in many senses, our own privilege, but how that privilege that we have has been at the expense of other people in the world.
Okay, perfect, perfect. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. My guests again, Jen Marlowe and Sue Gilbert. You can find out more about them at conversationslive.net. If you didn't catch any of that, they're both premiering this weekend, one in Tacoma and the other in Seattle. Feedback on this show, you can reach me at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617. Thank you so much for being with us today. Live well, live strong. See you next week.
Join us October 12th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair to learn about the movement that's already helped millions of people. Following the gang-related murder of his son, Azeem Kamisa was devastated, but he now carries his inspirational message of forgiveness, peace, and hope into the world. Hailed by dignitaries such as the Dalai Lama, former President Bill Clinton, and Al Gore, Azeem joins Vicki St. Clair for Conversations Live on Monday, October 12th at noon Pacific. Call 800-495-7617 for more information.